Hi there. Welcome to
We Need to Talk, a podcast that helps empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, one daughter and seven sons who range in age from 19 up to 36 years. Each episode, I'm talking with an expert on a particular social issue. From bullying to climate change, from pornography to the human brain and our need for connection. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, I'm talking with Professor Mark Williams, a cognitive neuroscientist who spent over 25 years researching the connection between the human brain and our behaviour. Mark's taught thousands of students and teachers about how to have a healthy brain, and many more in the wider community with his numerous media appearances. He's had published over 70 scientific articles, along with his illuminating book, The Connected Species. Mark and I discuss what drives our brain to think as it does, and how we can master it to overcome serious issues such as bullying and racism, along with negative behaviour stemming from gender expectations around each sex. Mark points out how kindness, compassion, and empathy shape our brains to improve individual and community well-being. So sit back and make yourselves comfortable for a fascinating discussion with Professor Mark Williams. Welcome, Dr. Mark Williams, to We Need to Talk. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time today. Just wanted to start off with, first of all, what is exactly a cognitive neuroscientist?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So we've had neuroscientists for a long time, which is basically people who study the brain, and there's everything from down at the cellular level all the way to the whole animal. But about 35 years ago, we started doing more human research on live humans because we had the new technology such as MRIs to actually look at human brains. And so they came up with the term cognitive neuroscientist to differentiate us from the animal neuroscientists that were looking at monkeys and rats and all of those things. So it basically means a human, live human neuroscientist.
Right. Okay. That clarifies it. So cognitive, that falls into that, the word cognitive neuroscientist in relation to humans?
Yeah. So cognitive just refers to the fact that they're awake and they're thinking. So we look at awake humans who are actually thinking. Because prior to that, most of the research on humans was done post-mortem. So it was done with people who had had brain injury or a stroke or something like that. Or damage due to some other injury. And so they really wanted to differentiate from that and also from all the animal research. So they came up with this term cognitive neuroscientist.
Okay.
It does also, we do have sleep researchers and so on who also fall under cognitive neuroscience. So it's not really just cognitive. It's a bit more than wider than cognitive, but it's supposed to be human neuroscience, if you like.
Okay, thank you. And what makes a person become one? What did anything make you become a cognitive neuroscientist who has done so much research?
Yeah, there was no courses in Australia on cognitive neuroscience. So I did a double major. I was doing science. I did a double major in psychology and in neuroscience. And I really fell in love with both of those things, but more of the disorders in the psychology area and in the physiology area, the neurophysiology. So I managed to get into the neurophysiology stream, which was difficult to get into. And I fell in love with both of those. And then I went to MIT in the USA, where I actually worked with someone who was a cognitive neuroscientist. So that's sort of how I got into it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, great place to do research. You don't go, the bar's high there, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I think it's the top university in the world now, isn't it?
It's always in the top four, and it depends on the discipline that you're looking at. So if you're in engineering and in neuroscience and science generally, computer science, you know, all of those hard sciences, it's always seen as number one.
Yeah.
Harvard often knocks it off in relation to things like medicine, because it specializes more in medicine.
Okay.
But they actually share all the resources because they're right next to each other, MIT and Harvard.
Yeah, that's
right. So, yeah, there's a lot of overlap between the two, but they're always the top two. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But look, I just wanted to first of all say to you, I'm older than you, I believe. So we have a responsibility, I feel, Mark, to, given that we've had half our lives or more without technology, and half our lives with it, I feel that we have a responsibility. We're a part of a dying breed, you know, where we've had both, to educate and spread the word that, hey, this isn't good for us, this technology, this social media. And you write a lot about that in your wonderful book, The Connected Species, how understanding the evolution of the human brain can help you reconnect with the world, which is a wonderful read, and thank you so much for putting that out there so everybody can learn all about that, and we'll talk about that more. But are you really feeling that so much at the moment? I mean, I can see it myself. I've got 8 children, 7 sons, 1 daughter, and half of them have had their lives without as much technology, and half have. And I think the hardest one is the 18-year-old who's spent so much time e-gaming. And you know, but what's your take on all of that? Do we have this responsibility? And I know that you're really quite anti the social media.
Yeah, I think we really do. I think we're being tricked and manipulated, and I think that's really sad. And I think we need to be a little bit more honest about the way we ourselves are using these technologies and the way, yeah, we're allowing our kids to be using these technologies, because they're missing out on so much of their own time. And it's only going into the coffers of these billionaires over in the US, you know.
Yep.
I mean, we're making huge amounts of money, and they're making it off our time, which is our lives, literally our lives. I saw a recent little schematic which was showing that if a kid continues to be using social media, the average amount of time that, or not just social media, but gaming and all those things on the internet, they'll spend something like 40 years or something of their lives on a device.
Wow.
I mean, that's really, really sad, because you're not doing anything meaningful when you're doom scrolling or when you're playing a game or whatever. I mean, these things aren't good for our brains, and we know they're not good for our brains, and we know there's increases in early onset dementia. I mean, the biggest increases in dementia, which is increasing at a rate of 300% every 2 years, is amongst 25 to 35-year-olds. That 25 to 35-year-olds are getting early-onset dementia, dying within about 10 years, and it's increasing by 200, 300% a year. And I think we've got to start really thinking about what we're doing, because it is a use-it-or-lose-it paradigm, right? We've got to use our brains or else we lose our brains. And so many kids aren't using them. And so many adults aren't using them in the right way, and it's scary.
Totally. And I mean, you know, they say, oh, well, it connects us with everybody worldwide. But really, you say that we're more disconnected since social media, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We know that the more time you spend on social media, the less friends you have in real life. The more friends you have on social media, the less friends you have in real life. Like, being on social media is not social. There's nothing actually social about social media. It's about advertising, and you're either advertising your business or you're advertising yourself. Mm. And to have teenagers growing up thinking that it's appropriate to be advertising themselves online to people they don't know, and that's just a really distorted way to bring up a teenager, which isn't why neither of my teenagers are on social media, and neither of them will have social media accounts until they're 18, because they don't need it.
And good on you.
They absolutely don't.
I was
don't
that
need
strong.
It. But we didn't know before, right? I mean, we now know. We now know the data. We've now seen what they're actually doing and how they're manipulating both ourselves and our kids. We've seen how many suicides there are over a year as a result of social media. I mean, the kids are literally killing themselves because of this. So we actually need to do something to stop that. And I've done, you know, work with anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, and increases in eating disorders amongst both boys and girls, right? Even in boys, it's increasing dramatically because of social media is really, really sad. And it's an awful disease for everybody involved, the family especially, because there isn't a good cure at the moment.
No.
And so, yeah, we need to be thinking about
absolutely.
This seriously.
Yeah, and also you were mentioning killing themselves. We had a recent very tragic situation. We've had a number of very tragic situations of school kids killing themselves at such a young age. And so cyberbullying is a massive problem, isn't it? Whereas I was bullied when I was 14 at an all-girls Catholic school, and that's why I'm such a big advocate of anti-bullying and really promote that with all of my kids. I've always said, don't be a bystander. Get in there. If you see it happening, tell the bully, go and tell the teacher. And, you know, but nowadays we have, when I was bullied, at least I'd go home and have a little bit of, it was a haven home, you know, it was a bit of time out from it all. But these poor kids, they go home and they're still being bullied so much. They can't, it's almost like they can't turn it off.
Yeah, it is. And I'm really sorry that happened to you. Oh, and it shouldn't happen to anybody, but it does happen. But we know that if you get rid of the devices out of schools, you decrease not only cyberbullying, but you also decrease normal bullying because kids can then empathize with each other because they're actually looking at each other's facial expressions and they're understanding their emotions and they're actually connecting with each other. So we need to get rid of them from the schools, but we also need to get rid of them from home because at home they need a rest as well, right? I mean, it's not just the kids who have been bullied. It's all of the kids, the poor girl or boy who is confused about their body and he's seeing all these, you know, pictures online of these made up, and they're not real. They're all fake, right? These fake bodies and all the rest of it and what they should look like and shouldn't look like. And they're getting bombarded with that all the time. We don't need that all the time. We need to relax and we need to stop and we need to hang out with friends and we need to talk to each other. We need to talk to family and we need to talk to grandparents and we need to,
have time off it. Oh, yeah, time off it. I was involved in teaching a course a few years ago at uni how our connection with each other has gone from sitting around the dining table, because let's face it, it's collecting dust, in between Easter and Christmas, whereas we used to sit around the dining table, ask each other how our day was, and that face-to-face interaction and just talking about that, Mark. So as human species, what do we carry forward with natural selection when we're born?
Yeah, so we are the connected species, which is why I called us that, because we're not the strongest species out there, of course, and we're not the fastest species, and we actually don't have the biggest brain or the most complex brain of any species. We became the alpha species because of the fact that we connect, right? Because of the fact that we're able to connect, and we evolve this amazing brain, and most of our brain is actually dedicated to connection, to actually empathizing with each other, to understand. I mean, just prosody of the voice, right, is amazing and really complex thing to understand. The emotions and everything that someone's trying to portray when we're talking to each other, plus facial expressions and the faces, like we recognize thousands and thousands of faces and they're really, really important to us, and body language. You know, there's so many, it's so complex, and it's something that we need to be doing more regularly because you've got to learn all those things. And also it's something that which is really, really good for us. We know from the blue zone, so the areas around the world where people live over 100, more than anywhere else. And we know that they are spread out around the world. It's not because they're in the most wonderful place in the world, but they're actually spread out around the world. And looking at those, they've found that it's actually the number one thing that all of those areas do is they sit down and break bread together on a regular basis. It's all about actually spending time together, and that's actually what's good for us. And then the Harvard study that came, it comes out every 5 years, and the 75th year of it came out last year or the year before, 75 years worth of data on a huge number of people. And all of that analysis over 75 years has shown that the number one way we can increase our lifespan by 10 to 15 years, which is a good thing for someone at my age, decrease the likelihood.
Yes, please.
Decrease the likelihood that we'll have neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and all those things, decrease mental health issues, increase or improve our cardiovascular system, and make us just happier in general is just to sit down with someone you know and trust on a regular basis.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the most wonderful thing that we can actually do. And sadly, kids aren't doing it. We've got this epidemic of loneliness in our schools today.
Yes.
I regularly present at schools, and I present to the different year groups on our brain. And one of the things I talk to them about, you know, you want to increase your IQ, you want to get smarter, then sit down with your friends on a regular basis and chat to them. And I always ask them how many people could please, you know, tonight or tomorrow, call someone they know and trust outside of their family, sit down with them and actually chat to them. And year seven, I usually get about 90% of them put up their hand and say yes. By after year nine, because year nine's a bit of a hump year, by after year nine, year 10, 11, 12, you get down to about 10% who actually have one person outside their family that they can actually trust to sit down and have a chat to.
Yeah,
that's just really sad.
I'd believe that. Well, like I said to the group of students, uni students, I said, you've got all these inverted commas friends you're connected to, but really how many would come to you? Yeah, how many do you trust? And I know this sounds a bit, you know, extreme, but how many would come to your funeral too, you know?
Yeah.
And it just got them thinking and, you know, it's quite on this superficial level and it's about more quantity rather than quality. And a lot of them lack confidence to then interact personally. You mentioned the word empathy, and that is just so important, isn't it, to nurture amongst all of us. So do you think we're lacking in a lot of empathy in the schools because of the social media focus?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that year six kids here in Australia, if we take them off the devices just for 5 days, there's a beautiful study done. They just took them off device, all devices, for 5 days, and they had an improved ability to recognise facial expressions and improved empathy for each other.
Mm.
That means they have abnormal ability to empathise with each other in grade five in this country. And we have more devices than any other country in the world. Of the OECD countries, we are number one when it comes to devices, and we're also number one when it comes to behavioural problems.
Right. So there's a big correlation there. Yeah. No surprise.
If you can't empathise with people around you, you're not going to behave in the classroom because you're not going to understand the teacher's upset with you. And we know that there's issues with facial expression perception. We know that kids or toddlers whose parents use smartphones regularly have abnormal facial expression perception at toddler age because of the fact that's, well, you actually learn what the different facial expressions mean because of your care, right? Because a toddler will, you know, be at a park and they'll do something funny and they'll feel good, they'll feel joy. They'll look at their carer and the carer will be smiling because they just saw them do something funny and they understand that that facial expression goes with this feeling, or they'll fall over and hurt themselves and they'll feel bad and they'll look up to the carer will look sad and they'll know that's facial expression goes with this awful feeling.
Right.
But at the moment, because every time they do something, they look up to their carer and the carer is on the phone, they don't, and so they have what we call a still face effect. So there's a huge problem with the still face effect.
Can you explain that a little bit further?
So that's just that they don't use their faces. So regardless of their emotion, they'll have a still face. They'll have a neutral face.
Right.
And then they have to go to a clinic and actually get taught how to use different facial expressions.
Wow.
Because they don't get taught it naturally in a natural environment.
That's sad, isn't it?
It's so sad.
That is so sad. So what are your thoughts about the relatively recent banning of mobile phones in all public schools in New South Wales?
I've got to get out of the private schools as well. Really going to depend because several states have done it previous years. It's really just New South Wales and Queensland that have just got on board. They're a bit late to the party. But I've worked with a lot of schools, especially in WA and so on, where it's been banned for a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it really depends on how the principal implements it. And some principals are strong on it and it's been great. Like they do it slowly over a couple of terms. And then it's done, and then everybody's got to stay off the phones, and they're not allowed. And if they get caught with them, then there's, you know, serious repercussions for doing that. And that's great. And you find those schools are fantastic, and the kids are out playing with each other at lunchtime, playing with each other at recess, and, you know, doing all those
wonderful
things, which is so important. Yeah. But then there are principals who are laxed about it. So, of course, the staff are laxed about it. And then, you know, the kids will have them in their pockets, and they'll be pulling them out on the side. And you don't get the same benefits when that happens. So it really does depend on the individual principal. So parents out there, I would say talk to your principal and say, you want it as a strong.
Yes.
You want you to go hard because it really does make a positive, really positive impact.
Yeah, well, I was reading some research findings just recently saying that there has been a huge positive effect in their results, kids' results at mm-hmm. school across all subjects. They seem happier. You know, there's less bullying.
Less bullying, yeah.
How wonderful.
Less behavioural issues in classrooms.
Less behavioural issues.
Now we just got to get the devices out of the classrooms and we'll be all good.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And I was reading also that the Scandinavian countries have had this going for quite a while. And but they're also, from a young age, more about teaching the risks and the damage that can be caused by technology. And I think it's really important that kids aren't just told, no, you can't use it, but really understand the issues that it can cause. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's the same as sugar, alcohol, drugs, right? We need to be teaching the kids why we're restricting these things and how they should be managed. And because at some stage they're going to get out of school or they're going to have access. And so it's you want them to have the knowledge once they get to that point. And we have good programs around alcohol and we have programs around drugs and around sugar. Mm-hmm. So we should be doing exactly the same thing around the devices and around social media and around pornography and all of those things.
Oh, boy, don't
even
get me
started. There's so many areas that we need. But at the moment, there's this idea that if you ban the phones, then you don't teach literacy. And so, therefore, you've got to have the phones in the school so you can teach literacy, which is just so naive.
Yeah.
And it's I think it's a lot of people who are making money out of having the phones in the school, so they're banned.
Yes. One of my sons is a high school teacher, and he said critical thinking is a big area that we really need to teach the students. Because, if they can't think of it for themselves, you're right. When they leave school, they're going to have the impact from it all out there. So they need to understand it. And from a young age, primary upwards. Mm. It was interesting. Another of my sons came home the other day after seeing that wonderful movie called A Complete Unknown with Timothy Chalamet playing a young Bob Dylan. Fantastic film. And he came home and he said, I wish life was like that, where everybody, you just sit back, strum the guitar. And I have to say, we've always introduced music and the different performing arts with all of our kids, whether they like painting or singing. How important do you think is promoting you're looking at the performing arts and promoting all of that and creativity for brains, young brains?
Absolutely. Yeah. Essential. We need to be using our whole brains to keep them. I mean, it's the same as your muscles, right? If you decide to go into the gym and just do, bicep curls all day, every day, and then you go pick up a box, you're going to hurt your back and you're going to hurt your legs. And
right?
You've got to actually be exercising your whole body for your whole body to actually be strong and for you to do all those things. And it's the same with your brain. You've got to be exercising your whole brain to keep the whole brain actually active and healthy and all of those things. So, doing things like creative arts plus doing some more analytical stuff and a mixture of things is really, really important for us. And the more we can do that, the better. But especially music, we don't understand music. I was on some documentary quite a few years ago now called Music in the Brain for Catalyst. It's amazing how music is so innate for us as humans, and we seem to have been doing it for millions of years, unlike reading. Reading's a very new thing. Reading's only the last generation or two that we've actually been able to read, right?
Right.
Our brains actually haven't evolved to enable us to read. We use other areas of our brain to do reading, which is why it's amazing that all kids learn how to read, because it's not something we've actually evolved to do. Whereas music is something that we seem to have evolved to do. It's very primitive, very old, and we would have been doing it for many years. And so, I think learning music, some musical instrument or an appreciation of music is really, really important. But also the arts, I think, being creative and is just beautiful.
You've probably seen Ken Robinson's TED Talk. I think it's the most watched TED Talk, the late Ken Robinson. And he was an expert on education and an author. And he's great TED Talk. Are schools killing creativity? And he argued that, yes, in many ways they are. And it's okay, these STEM subjects, the maths and sciences, okay, great. But if you need a balance, right, you can't just be focusing on that. You need to have these creative subjects there. And having kids have the opportunity, it's very sad that there's a really, a lot of it can be luck, you know, whether your parents can afford to pay for it, whereas other kids can't afford that luxury of having, being able to play an instrument, etc. So that's why I'm a big advocate of having the government provide all of these things to every child. So they've got they've got equal opportunity. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was at Edgecliff, Sydney Grammar School, their Edgecliff campus, Edgecliff Prep, and I was amazed. I mean, the Sydney Grammar School is arguably has best outcomes in Australia.
Mm.
And you think, given that they're amazing outcomes in relation to, you know, maths and science and you know, top ATARs and all the rest of it, you think that that's just what they do. But every student in primary school has to learn two musical instruments.
Oh, really?
And they it's part of their coursework. It's
fantastic.
Essential. Their arts department was just beautiful, and it was amazing the stuff they were doing in art. And again, it was a huge focus of the school was their arts. And so all the way through from kindy all the way to year 12, they got to learn two instruments, and they do, you know, a lot of artwork because they know, again, that it improves their IQ and it makes us smarter and all the rest of it, and they end up very successful. So, I don't think it's not a compromise. It actually helps with the outcomes by actually doing those other curricular things.
Yes.
And should be part of all curriculums. And unfortunately, our public schools aren't doing it as well because we don't have, I think, enough of that, those extracurricular things in the schools, essentials.
Well, you know where we have to go one day, lobby the Parliament House and say, jump up and down and say,
Put the arts back into the primary schools and the high schools and,
oh, totally.
Fund it. But then we've also got the problem that the universities are killing all the arts programs as well.
Oh, yes.
That's
horrendous, you know, cutting the humanities. I mean, how fantastic. Some of our biggest thinkers, you know, over the centuries have been, philosophers, et cetera. I mean, we have to actually have that focus as well, don't we?
We do. And I mean, cutting the history department at the moment, I mean,
whereas how much does history teach you, right?
Yes.
You know, we look at the
past. We're repeating what we did not that long ago. And people need to understand.
Yeah.
And you need historians to do that.
Totally. We've got to understand the history of nations and our past to really say, well, we've got to learn from what's happened and move forward.
Move forward rather than backwards.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to ask you, Mark, so we're born, we have the natural selection, we recognise faces, you know, etc. What happens then? We're socially conditioned, aren't we, you know, by our environment, and we can actually, this need for connection can tip over into, you call them isms in your book, you know, sexism, racism. Can you explain that and how can we prevent that happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's something that's really being manipulated at the moment through social media and on the internet. But we are driven to find our in-group, right, to find the group that we belong to so that we can work together to actually benefit each other. And that's what our brains are really set up to do. For example, one of the really neat things is our ability to recognize facial expressions is quite amazing because all faces are actually very similar. Because they all have two noses.
Well, you might have two noses.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm glad I don't. I've got teenagers. You wouldn't want two noses with teenagers in the house. So we've all got the two eyes, one nose and one mouth, and it's all in the same orientation. So how we actually, and we can recognize people over long periods of time, right? You've probably had the experience, you haven't seen anyone, an individual for 15 years. And you run into them and they've changed a lot. They might have put on weight or lost weight and extra wrinkles and makeup on or whatever.
Yeah.
Hair's different. And you still recognize them.
Yeah.
And we do that because we calculate the ratio of the eyes to each other, to the mouth, to the nose. So it's actually that compared to this normative one that we have in our brain, and everything's compared to that normative one. And that normative one is based on the average of all the faces that we've seen. Mm. So if you only see Caucasian faces, for example, then your average will be biased towards Caucasian faces. So you'll recognize Caucasian faces much better, and you'll remember Caucasian faces much better, and you'll see Caucasian faces as part of your in-group. So you'll react to that. Whereas anything that deviates from that will be seen as outside of your group, which is why the more multicultural a society is, the more general that template becomes. We call it a template. That template becomes. And so the less likely you are to react to that. And we know homogeneous countries like Japan, for example, the OECD have classified Japan as the most racist country in the world because they only see Japanese faces. They're in their media, they're in their, and they're very isolated, and they don't have a lot of foreigners living in Japan. And so their templates would be very Japanese. And there's been lots of studies showing that they recognize other Japanese people really easily, but they don't recognize people outside of that race very easily at all. Whereas people from more heterogeneous countries will recognize a range of people, a range of different races quite well, and not have that automatic response. And so we need to sort of see lots of faces, and we know that can change. Mm. So if we get kids and kids are looking at lots and lots of different faces from lots of different races, then their template will be much broader than the narrow template that you get when you're only seeing the one race.
Right. Okay. So the younger that we expose kids to multi-races is better?
Is much better, yeah. So we need to be doing that regularly. But we've also, of course, got the stereotypes associated with the different races, which we need to get rid of as well, which comes from the media. And we need to eliminate that from the media and the things that they read,
right?
Which we are now. I mean, there is movements in that direction, which is great. And we still got a long way to go. But eliminating both of those is really important. But just being aware of it, right? We know there was a fantastic study done where that was done in England. So they were talking to, for example, they're talking to Liverpool fans, football, and the Liverpool fans would come in and they talk about Liverpool and how Liverpool doesn't get as much funding as some of the other clubs, and Liverpool, you know, should be a much better club than it is, and because they've been successful in the past, and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And then that wasn't the experiment. The experiment was then they watched them walk outside, and they had Confederate come from the other side who would have a Manchester United shirt on, which is competition.
Yeah.
And they'd be walking across the road and they'd drop something in front of the Liverpool fan and they'd just see what they actually did. Now, if they were in the lab and they talked about Liverpool and how important Liverpool was as a club, then the person would ignore them and just walk straight past them. Mm-hmm. But if they were in the lab and they talked about how the English league doesn't get as much funding as European league and how important the English league is to the whole thing and that they should be, then they walked out and they walked past a Manchester person. The Manchester person dropped something. They would actually stop, pick up the stuff and help them and then start talking to them about the league.
Right.
Because the group had changed.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You've primed them that you're in a little group, which is Liverpool, or you prime them you're in a bigger group, which is the whole of the English league.
Yep.
You know, and that we need to realise is that, you know, there's been books written about tribalism, but it's not like tribalism where you have a tribe and that's it, right?
Yep.
Our groups can increase and decrease all the time. You know, we're talking today. I live on the Northern Beaches, Sydney. Now, I was recently down in Melbourne presenting, and I talked about the fact that I lived in Sydney, and of course the crowd was like,
oh yeah,
and I went, but I actually grew up in Melbourne, and then they're like, and then I said,
like, well, you now,
yeah, I was a Cats fan, and of course. There's a couple of people in the audience who are Cat fan who were like, yeah, but all there's a whole bunch of other people who are like, oh, boo.
Right? Yes.
I was changing my group very dynamically in front of them and then explained to them about groups. And they're like, oh, well, that's why you're doing that, right? We can easily change, who we are. I can talk about the fact that I grew up in Victoria and ignore the fact that I live in Sydney when I'm down there. And when I'm up here, I can talk about that. Or if I'm in WA, I can talk about the fact that I grew up in Australia, right? And it changes that dynamic.
So the more broad the group, the easier it is for people to connect. Whereas if you narrow it down, then they'll have that bit of the pack mentality, one against the other. Group against the other. Can I just talk about that pack mentality, which we often see, don't we, amongst males in particular? Because mm-hmm. I've done a lot of research on how gender expectations around masculinity can, I call it the double-edged sword. You know, one side it tips over into depression and suicide, and the other side, and it can tip over into bullying or violence. So, and aggression. Okay. So these gender expectations, and gender is a social construct. We're born a sex, and then we have these gender expectations, and because you're this sex, you must be this. Have you seen with your research that causes a lot of problems where a lot of males feel they have to be a certain way, and
it's like they feel empowered in a pack,
but when you get them on their own, then they're more open to talking about more sensitive topics, whereas they've got to act tough in that group. But look, sorry, if you can pick something out from there. Went on and on there, but you can tell that that's a real passion of mine. But anyway, what do you have to say about
that? Yeah, no, it's what I think we need to do is realise that gender and sex are two separate things. And I think, unfortunately, two things have been married together. And that's a real problem in our society at the moment is we don't – We talk about gender as though it's sex, right? We talk about gender equality, and we're not actually talking about gender. We're talking about sex equality, right? And we talk about gender pay gap, and it's not gender pay gap because it's not a difference between people who are masculine and feminine. It's actually a sex pay gap, and we should be talking about sex pay gap because the difference between males and females. They don't have any data on masculine versus feminine. So we need to change that so that we can actually talk about sex, which is male and female, and that specifically, you know, you are born either male or female, unless there's the odd one in the middle,
unusual. That's right, very, very tiny percentage intersex, where you have.
And then we have the gender, which is masculine to feminine, which is a continuum, and which actually changes, right? I'm much more masculine if I'm go to the brewery with a couple of mates and we're talking about the football compared to when I take my daughter shopping for, you know, clothes and so on. And she loves me taking her shopping because I actually enjoy doing that with her. And I'm much more feminine when I do that. And we've got to realize that that is, and that the gender is a social construct, right?
Yeah, it is. And people forget that. And what's happened is they've replaced the word sex with gender, and that has caused a lot of issues. It was really, I was reading, sorry to interrupt, but in the 1950s, you know, John Money from New Zealand was a very well-known academic, and he went over to America, and it was only him, because gender, the word, has been around for thousands of years, and it was used as a category, but he thought, oh, you know what, let's use the word gender instead of sex. And then, of course, you've had it all through the last, it's not that long ago, really, when you're looking at it, only about 70 years, that word has replaced what sex a person is. And it's a mistake because it's caused a lot of issues around gender expectations for each sex, et cetera. So I'm sorry to have interrupted.
No, you're right. And it's caused a lot of confusion. And nothing frustrates me more than when I get a form and it says gender and it says male or female or and tick the box. And I scribble it out and I say, well, masculine at the moment. It's like, let's
be
honest.
Just, you know, they ask, what gender are you? No, I'm not choosing a gender. Yeah. Male or female, exactly. Yeah. That's right.
But I mean, masculine is different depending on which society you come from. If you're Balinese, two men who are very masculine are happy to sit there holding hands or cuddling each other, you know, and they'll actually greet each other by cuddling each other and so on. And we'd actually be very touchy with each other, and that's completely fine, and that's very masculine, and there would be no problem at all. Or if you go to Europe, but you know, in Italy, masculine men are dressed very nicely and have very, you know, a very look after themselves and everything. And same with feminine. I mean, feminine changes between different social groups. I mean, there's the feminine idea that you've got, you know, the Kim Kardashian with all the makeup on and the boobs being done and up and all the rest of it goes on there versus the idea of the mother, right? And the woman who actually looks after the kids, and which is also very, very, very feminine.
Oh,
you know, I grew up, I love the beach and I love surfing, and there's this surfy girl feminine, right, which is strong and sporty and in the beach and in the water and mermaid and does all that, right? There's lots of different versions of feminine. There's lots of different versions of masculine. Unfortunately, the internet is pushing boys to believe that masculine is a particular way of thinking, and that to be a male, you have to be masculine. And that's not true. To be a true male, you should be able to be whatever you want.
Well, I mean, it was really going back to, I think it was Aristotle's time, that he decided, well, let's divide males from females, you know, in the sense of women are weak, men are strong, women are cry, men don't cry. And it goes back even further, I'm sure, than that. But these categories of what's masculine or feminine, you know, I now really threw my supervisor for my PhD in late 2000s when I said to her, maybe, because I did a whole chapter on gender and a whole chapter on identity, because I was exploring postnatal depression from a sociological perspective, saying that the demands of the good mother, which are many, and we're still a very traditional bastion here in Australia around motherhood, can cause a lot of women to tip over into anxiety and depression. And anyway, so I said, wouldn't it be great if we had identity separate to gender, if gender didn't have to come into it at all? And she goes, oh, that might be just a bit too radical, radical, Jane. But I mean, really, we're as gendered as we want to be, but really it's the categories that how we're dividing them too. I mean, if you're talking about good masculinities, then you conversely, you're not going to be saying, well, they're good femininities. So why even talk about dividing it into masculine and feminine? Why not just say, well, these are good attributes that don't need to be gendered? I mean, really, it should only matter to our intimate partner, our differences in our biological sex, really. But why should we expect ourselves to be any different from a male if we're born a female and vice versa? I mean, except, of course, for the obvious physical difference in strength between males and females. You may have heard of Raewyn Connell, the world-renowned sociologist, who authored many of her books prior as R.W. Connell. She talks a lot about how there's more differences amongst each sex than there is between the sexes. And she's a famous Australian sociologist, and she's done a lot of work on that in America and here. And yeah, it's totally right. So we've got a lot that's tied into identity, haven't we, our sense of identity.
Yeah, and I think I have no problem with getting rid of the term gender, and I think it would make the world much simpler.
Well, there you go.
If we rid of it, we could have sexual orientation, right? You like having sex with.
Yeah.
And it can have sex, which is whether you're male or female, and that's all you really need.
I agree.
You need to know if the person's male or female, and you need to know who you like having sex with.
Yeah.
What do you need a gender for at all? Because we're all different, right? And as I was saying before, you know, I'm more feminine when I'm hanging out with my daughter than I am when I'm with my friends at the pub or when I'm doing other things, right?
Yeah.
And so why do I need to actually define what sort of masculinity I am? And the masculinity changes across the different societies and different ethnic groups and all the rest of it. So therefore it's quite a meaningless term that we really shouldn't be.
It is,
but
I'm just wondering, so much is related to our sense of identity in taking on gender expectations, right?
Yeah.
You know, and particularly during those adolescent years, how am I expected to be as a male? How am I expected to be as a female? And that's where a lot of that bullying, I'm not saying it doesn't happen in primary, but it reaches its height, you know, around the 14-year mark, age 14. So what do you think we can do more in the school system? I'm all about this education because knowledge is power. From a young age that we can say, like we were talking about, performing arts, a lot of boys feel, oh, I don't want to dance. I don't want to perform. That looks a bit sissy. What can we do? Promote people to be I think whatever they want to be.
Yeah, we need to get rid of the sexism that we currently have in schools, right? As soon as kid gets to kindergarten, all of a sudden they're separated into males and females. Well, why? There's no difference between them at that age. Yeah. And in actual fact, our brains, which is what you're actually trying to work on or work with when you're at school, our brains, male and female brains, are no different to each other. All the research, all the meta-analysis shows there's no difference between a male brain and a female brain, except for a tiny little gland. And it's slightly shaped differently in males and females because of the hormones, the sex hormones that are released from it. Other than that, the brains are identical.
Yeah.
So why are we separating males and females? And I think if we stop doing that and we stop treating males and females differently in school and in preschool, to be honest, they start doing it in preschool, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
Then we would probably, we'd eliminate a lot of it. You're going to have to retrain a lot of teachers, of course, to actually manage to do that. But I remember at my kids' school, they brought in gender-neutral toilets because they were doing a refurb, and they decided that if they just had a normal toilet with a lockable door on each thing that either males or females could use and then had the sinks out the front, then they'd be a lot cleaner and the kids wouldn't go in there and mess about the way they often do, which actually works really, really well, and it's a much healthier way to have the things. And there was a huge fuss by some parents about the fact they were having gender-neutral toilets, which actually turned out to be fantastic. But I had talked to my kids about it and said, you know, is this a problem with the students? And they said, no, we don't care, and we don't care about that stuff. Oh. It's only you oldies that really make a big fuss about it. I was like, that I think is really nice, right, is that the next generation probably aren't going to give a stuff about all this gender stuff.
Exactly.
It's only us oldies that actually make a big fuss over it, because we were trained for umpteen years through the school system and through society to think that there is a difference between males and females, and there really isn't.
No.
Between the two.
Just going back to the word gender, really, it's a choice, isn't it? We should make it a choice. You know, we shouldn't be saying also we need to get rid of gender. I mean, people say they want to be non-binary or they want to be transgender. Fantastic. Of course, I support that. But that's about choice, not about because you're a male, because you're a female, this is the way you need to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of research too on female bullying too, that there are back in the 80s, it's a new form of femininity where it's looked down upon. You know, the old days, girls are sort of meant to be softer and acquiesce, whereas now the girl power movement, if you're not strong and confident, often a lot of those girls can be picked on who lack that. So, yeah, it causes issues. And I found with my research on postnatal depression, once I interviewed 20 women who'd been diagnosed with postnatal depression, quite severe, and once they lifted those expectations of themselves, that's what worked for them to alleviate that depression. So we're talking about the racism, the sexism. What else? You promote the fact that we need to be focusing on kindness, compassion. You're involved in teaching a lot of that, Mark, in the schools. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I think we need to get back to how we evolved, right? We evolved to be compassionate. We evolved to be kind. We evolved to actually empathize with each other. And we do that automatically. And we don't do that enough. We're scared to do that these days because we've been told that we're all evil, right? I mean, the Lord of the Flies book was not true. That's not what would happen if you stuck a whole bunch of kids on an island. They'd actually all hunch around and cuddle each other and try to make each other feel better and then try to survive as best they could. They wouldn't.
And that's innate?
And that's innate, yeah.
Right.
And we know that's innate. And I think it's really sad that one of the things, principals always have a heart attack when I go and talk to teachers, and I always say one of the biggest problems in schools is that teachers don't touch their students enough because they don't, right? We've got this whole hands-off approach to kids, and kids, kindergarten kids need to be cuddled. They need to be, and you get that automatically. You see someone crying, you want to actually cuddle them because it's an innate response that we have, because when you cuddle someone, when you touch someone, we have C fibers in our skin which only activate to touch, and they release oxytocin in our brain, which make us feel more connected to each other and make us feel calmer and relaxed and part of the in group. And so, you know, teachers need to be shaking, in high school, they need to be shaking every student's hand as they enter the classroom and saying hello to them, actually eyeballing them, which is really, really important for that connection, but also getting that oxytocin going so that they actually feel connected to each other, so they can actually sit down and actually work with each other. But even in, you know, we need that, and we need that in society. And that was one of the sad things about COVID, because we were told we're not allowed to touch each other, and we haven't got back to that. I find, because I always shake hands, and if not, I'll cut the person. We lost that, and a lot of people are now scared of doing that. But that's very innate for us as humans to actually touch each other, to get that oxytocin so that we actually feel connected to each other.
Fantastic. So yes, it makes a lot of sense. And just touching one another when you're chatting on the shoulder,
tapping,
it makes people feel I'm being understood, or that warmth from the person.
They're listening to me.
Yes.
They're connected to me.
And listening is such a vital skill, isn't it,
in life? And for a teacher just to put a hand on a shoulder, or a beautiful story about a teacher was telling me the other day who I was interviewing, and he had a student come to him many years afterwards who had ended up, I think he ended up being a very successful CEO. But when he was at school, he had a lot of issues, and he had a lot of family issues and so on. Yeah. And he said to this teacher, I don't know if you remember, but, you know, you really changed my attitude. And one thing you did which really changed my attitude was one day I was going home. I was on my way home, and you came out of the classroom as I was walking along. And he said, oh, hang on. And I turned around. I thought I was in trouble, because he was getting in trouble all the time. I thought I was in trouble. And you said, oh, no, your backpack's on wrong. And my backpack was twisted. And you turned it around the right way. And then you put your arm around me and said, hope you have a good night tomorrow, and see you tomorrow. And he said it completely changed the way, you know, the trajectory that I was on at the time.
Going. That's all it took.
Yeah, and that's all it really does take, right? It's just to have someone to actually notice you.
Yep.
And I think in schools that's so important. We need to be noticed. Kids need to be noticed. Teachers need to be noticed. Everybody needs to be noticed.
Absolutely. I think we can't underestimate how powerful a teacher can be. Remember that? Well, I remember Mum and I used to love watching movies when I was in my teenage years on the Friday night, the old Hollywood movies. And one of our favourites was a 1939 movie, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And Mr. Chips was such a well-loved teacher. And when my son became a high school teacher, I said, oh, you'll be like a Mr. Chips, you know, where he didn't have any of his own kids. But when he was dying, he said, I had thousands of children, you know, and they have such a positive, can have such a powerful impact on the students. So what we feed our brains, Mark, so we're born, we recognize facial features, but we need to continually feed our brains, don't we, with, you know, positive messages, knowledge. And that is just so important, because I know that when I read The Power of Positive Thinking and How to Win Friends and Influence People when I was 14 to help me, that was like my best friend during that bullying year, they stayed with me, right? You know, and I just fed my brain every day because my mother and father weren't accessible to talk to, really. So do you think that we need to be training our brains and just taking that quiet time, something you speak about in your book, which I totally agree with? We're not sitting down and just staring out the window. You know, we feel we've always got to be busy. So this instinct that you talk about, that we all have, should we be taking a lot more quiet time and listening to that instinct?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if it's true, but I heard a story yesterday or the day before about Michelangelo. And supposedly Michelangelo, when he was working for one of the families that paid him huge amounts of money to do what he was doing, and they noticed that every day he would come into his studio and he had a huge block of marble, and he'd sit there in front of the block of marble and just stare at it, and he'd stare at it for days and days. And then one day, the head of the family came and said, you know, what are you doing? You're not, you know, you're just sitting there all day. And he said, I'm working. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years later, that block of marble became David.
Ah, wow. Yeah. Okay.
and he just needed that time to think before he started. And you can imagine with marble, right? Because if you chip it in the wrong way or whatever, done, right? And it's, yeah, you've got to start again, and it's hugely expensive stuff. But we all need to do that. We all need to spend time. Yeah, and there's a great TED talk on procrastination and how important procrastination actually is for us. And procrastination is really just sitting there and trying to work, think through things. And we need access to our long-term memory because we don't have conscious access to our long-term memory, right? Our long-term memories has an abundant amount of information in it, and that's where all of our dreams happen. And our dreams, what happens when we're so-called dreaming is that we're running through thousands of scenarios in fast forward, right? Mm. Really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And so we're living thousands of lives every night when we're dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're all geniuses in there. We just got to get access to it.
Yeah.
And you get access to it by slowing down, by actually thinking, because you don't get access to it when you're busy. Because when you're busy, you're all in your action mode. And so you're in your working memory, which is your consciousness, is what we thought of to think about it in more general terms. But what hopefully people are using at the moment to listen to us is that working memory. And that's really limited. It's really capacity limited.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what we do to move around and to talk and to think and do those things. But in our long-term memory, there's huge amount of information, but we've got to empty that working memory, that consciousness, so we can get access to that long-term memory.
And we can only really do that by sitting quietly, taking quiet time. I think I read that Einstein, every afternoon, he said, that's it, I'm just going out sailing in the afternoons.
Yeah.
And he felt, I've been doing all this in the morning, I need to just chill. And relax.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense.
And he was also a huge walker.
He was?
Walk hours and hours a day, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he'd just go walking. Yeah. There's a whole group of different people who used to go with him because he'd mumble and they'd listen to what he was mumbling about.
What'd you say?
Yeah. He's trying to learn from him while he was walking. But he used to walk for hours.
Oh, wow. Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I wonder why then, before we finish, do you think people are reticent to sort of take time? Is it because it's frowned upon? If you're not busy all the time, you're not being productive, do you?
Oh, yeah. I saw a great keynote a little while ago. I was doing a keynote at a conference and, I've forgotten his name, but he was the coach for Ash Barty and for a whole bunch of other really famous sports people and so on. He was the life coach, so he kept them calm and got their attitude right and all the rest of it. I feel awful because I think it's Dan. I remember his name. But he was saying and he said a rude word, so I won't say the word, real word. But he said, when did busy become an emotion? He said, I often ask people, how are you? And they say, oh, I'm really busy. And he said, I'm not asking what you're doing.
Right.
I'm asking, how are you?
Yes.
Which is, are you happy? Are you sad?
Yeah.
Are you, living a good life?
Yeah.
Are you right? And everyone just says, I'm busy. And it's this whole, it's almost like it means that you're successful if you're busy all the time. And I don't think you are successful if you're busy all the time because you're not managing your time very well if you're busy all the time. And so we need to get rid of it as an emotion because it's not an emotion.
No.
If someone asks you how you are, think about how you feel and respond in that way. But also we need to slow down so that we can get more done because we get less done today. We're less productive today than we were 15 years ago because we're constantly being distracted by the stuff that's going on around us. So
particularly social media.
Especially social media.
Yeah.
Also our emails and all of those things.
Yeah.
And every time you get distracted, you lose about 90 seconds of your time.
Oh.
So every time your phone beeps or your little email, a little icon comes up, anything like that, you just lost 90 seconds of your time. So most people are losing about 2 or 3 hours of their day every day just because of notifications and things like that.
Wow.
So we're all working off about a 20-hour clock rather than a 24-hour clock.
Oh, wow.
Which is really sad.
That's really why
we're all so busy because we don't have, you're at work and you actually think you're working 8 hours, but you're only working 6 hours and you're trying to get the same amount of work done in 6 hours and you can't.
No.
So therefore you've got to work extra 2 hours at night to make up for that.
Yes.
But then you've got all those other distractions as well. So you've got to do 4 hours rather than 2 hours because you're not getting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so on. It continues.
So it's so much about self-discipline, isn't it?
We
have to just say no. I know that I feel a bit crappy if I'm looking at I don't often scroll through stuff. But if I start to, I just think, what am I doing, you know, with my time here? And I put it down and say, Jane, no, you know, focus on something else, even if it's just, you know, I'm a bit of an avid reader every day and just I'm much better off reading that for a couple of pages than scrolling through that, you know. So to be focused is really important, isn't it?
It is. We all need to be reading more often on books.
Mm, yeah.
We need to do that a lot more than what we are now. Most people don't read at all these days, which is really sad.
So sad.
And then they ask, why do my kids not read? And it's like, well, how many books do you read every day? Mm. Oh, I don't read at all. I haven't read a book. Haven't read a book in years. And it's like, well, they're going to do what you do. So
exactly.
If you're on your phone, they're going to be on their phone. And what are they learning from that? Well, so pick up a book and your kids will pick up a book as well. You'd be quite amazed.
Yeah, yeah, to learn by example. Mm. Finally, Mark, I always ask each of my guests, you know, there's a lot happening in the world at the moment, isn't there, right? And, you know... And you're an expert of the brain. What is there something that you would like to really say? You obviously do your work to help others, and knowledge is power. That's why I do my work. What do you want to say at the moment? Is there anything that you'd like particularly that you can see what's happening that you would like to just say to help people get their brains around it?
I mean, it's really hard. Because it feels as though it's out of control. It feels, well, at least to me, it feels as though it's out of control most of the time. But I think what we need to realize is that by acting locally, you do have an effect globally.
Mm-hmm.
And so volunteer.
Yeah.
Go and do something good somewhere. You know, volunteer. I do surf lifesaving regularly and I manage the water safety for the nippers and I try to do as much as I can because it makes me feel good.
Yes.
It's not about them. It's actually about me. I just started doing dippers, which is for... nippers for the disabled, which I've been doing. I did it last season. I'm doing it again this season, but we've got, I think, 14 kids in that program, but we've got a waiting list of over 20 kids because we just don't have enough volunteers for it. But, the joy I get out of it, I mean, yes, the parents are there and they're absolutely thrilled that their daughter and son, I have a little girl who I'm working with who's just amazing, who's nonverbal, but... Yeah, I get more out of it than they do, and I feel better than they do afterwards. And so do something for someone else, and that will have an impact on them, which means they'll do something for someone else and so on, and everybody can start working together to make this a much happier, better place for everybody. Yeah. But, yeah, we can do something. We just have to start local.
Yeah.
It'll spread.
The old butterfly effect, right? Mm.
Absolutely.
But no matter how big, it does have that ripple effect, big or small, but getting your mind off yourself and helping others. I think that's a fantastic thing to finish on. Wonderful point. And Mark, thank you so much for your time today. We could just go on and on, I reckon. But it's been wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jane. It's been great.
I hope you enjoyed this fascinating discussion with Professor Mark Williams as much as I did. And until next time, take good care of yourselves and each other. And remember, knowledge is power.